listening is just again give a very brief overview of what we have been reflecting on in order to situate a theme which I would like to develop initially and then move into the grieving scene at the group level. Because unless we can grapple with the group grieving, I believe we're not really getting to the heart of where the obstacles lie in the change process. Okay, let's revisit what we have been reflecting on. Go through the axioms. We began by saying that Jesus spoke to us about going out and teach ye all nations, teach ye all cultures. Notice he didn't say teach ye all individuals. It was that theme that Paul the VI took up in Evangelii Nuntiandi when he said that evangelization is not first and foremost of the individual, it's first and foremost of the culture. Evangelization, he says, is evangelization first and foremost of the culture, and through the culture to the individual. That is a very profound swing in evangelical studies. The hint of this is to be seen in the document on missionary activity, paragraph 22, where the fathers speak about the primary task of evangelization is to develop community in and through which the individual is both saved and sustained in salvation. Paul the VI goes further and clarifies that the community is not airy-fairy in a vacuum, it is incarnated in a culture. And until the culture can be addressed, there cannot be ultimately evangelization. We then went on, therefore, to look at the issue of culture. And we came up with the insight that culture is 98% feeling, it's in the gut primarily, it's not what we do primarily, it's what we feel about what we do. Then we analyzed the fact that culture is primarily resistance to change. Our most basic aspiration as an individual and as a group, at the subconscious level, is for the maintenance of the status quo. Therefore, how does change take place? How does radical change take place? There can be no radical change except through the chaos experience, which is, under whatever forces are involved, the radical breakdown of felt order. Yesterday, we looked more closely at the chaos in the church. Now, just those of us who went through this period in the 60s, prior to who were ordained before Vatican II, just feel the power of the symbolic change and all the associated feelings of discontent and disorientation when this happened. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, Amen, intro ibo ad altari Dei. Why? Oh, well, there's at least somebody who was ordained before. Oh, well, they're fine. Now, notice, when we were celebrating Mass according to this situation, we had our backs to the people. We were the medium, the intermedium between the people and God. We were way up here. Then overnight, we priests were told, invited, to turn around. Not to stand here, but actually to walk down into the congregation and say, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, good morning. My job is to build a loving, supportive, meaningful community. My job is to be the president of the worshiping community. Now, were we trained for that? Absolutely not. If we stumbled in the Latin, they said, isn't he holy? So, and now they discover we stumble in English, we can't put words together, we keep using same words over and over again, like meaningful, loving, and we go on and on and on, and they'll say to themselves, oh, if only they'd shut up. Now, you see, the incredible cultural change demanded, not just of them, but of we, the ritual leaders. from primarily a cultic position to developing a community sense in the people of God. We had no training for this. We had no assistance in developing the art of communication. By walking down into the congregation, no longer were we seen as something distant up there, but all our effect, we hadn't shaved properly, that we were looking old and haggard. All these factors were very obvious to people. We could hide them up there, but not down here. So from the that's just a symbol of the enormity of the change required through Vatican II. Is it therefore not surprising that many priests, frankly, couldn't get through that? Not at all surprising. Now, the second theme we developed was the chaos in the world. We spoke of postmodernism. And I think here, do you know The Simpsons? Is The Simpsons, the television show? Have you seen The Simpsons? Did you see The Brady Show in the 50s? Now, Brady Bunch. Here you have two symphonies. Here you have two examples, one of modernity and one of postmodernity. Think of the Brady Bunch. Problems solve within the family. All problems can be solved within the family. Authority structures neatly arranged. If a kid misbehaves, it's all right. It can be solved. He can get back to his identity. Contrast that with The Simpsons, and you have in The Simpsons a perfect model of what postmodernism is all about. Dysfunctionality, stupidity in paternal roles, antagonism between the kids, violence worked through in physical ways, and a sense of, and sometimes hopelessness, that problems can't be solved. Simpsons are about living chaos. Does it make sense? Yep. Notice how, again, the mass media begins to reflect and mirror, not just necessarily lead, mirrors the culture of the time. Okay, Monty Python is another one. You see, in the Monty Python ones, the humor is no longer with people, it's against people. You see what I'm getting at? And that again is one of the symptoms of the breakdown of order. And the humor can be, while we can laugh at it, it can be harsh, it can be abusive, it can be arrogant. And in a sense, as we'll see tomorrow, a corruption, or tonight, a corruption of humor. Right. Bearing this, therefore, in mind, the pastoral problem in refounding is this. Let's first of all go back to the notion of refounding. Refounding is the collaborative process of returning to the founding story of an organization. What's the primary founding experience of the organization? From that, getting the energy to move forward into the darkness and with risk into the unknown through quantum leap creative action. Give you an example of this. One day, walking with a Marist confrere in the southern parts of the Philippines, Cotabato, a very poor part, a young man who had in fact made a quantum leap pastoral change in the area by developing a new form of response to street children. Very creative quantum leap jump. Not an incremental jump, a dramatic pastoral jump. One day I said to him as we walked along, I said, "Pat, what made you do this? What happened?" He said, "When I first came and I would walk through the slums and see these kids on the streets, I began to develop a pain inside. I said, somebody must do something about this," he said. Then as time went on, I began to reflect, that's exactly what the founder did in France after the French Revolution, walking through the streets of Lyons and the rural parts of Lyons, looking at the poverty, the spiritual poverty of the families after the revolution. I began to feel what he felt. Then I reached a point when I felt I had to do something. Nobody else was doing anything. So I decided, I'll do it. And I began to feel that the founder was right with me. Now this is what we mean, as I said earlier, this is the faith shock. The shock that one experiences when one looks at the world and one looks at the gospel and says, I can't take it any longer. I cannot take it any longer. So if we look at the notion of refounding the church, it's a collaborative process of returning to the primary founding experience of the church, which is the Paschal mystery, to enter into the pain, the joy, the pain, and the resurrection of Christ. It's from there that one can move forward. Not to move into there is not to move into refounding. From there one gets the energy and the hope to move forward into the unknown. Okay. However, the implementation of this vision, the implementation of this energy, there are obstacles. And what's the first obstacle? What is the first obstacle? The one that really, in fact, rapidly can become the Waterloo. Fear, yes. Fear, yes.
Loss of faith.
Loss of faith, yes.
Discouragement,
yes. Ah, where? Yes. Yes. All these are true. But we're up against now, what's the axiom about culture? Culture is what? Culture is resistance to change. So what are you going to do about culture? How are we going to break through, through a refounding process, culture which by definition is resistance to change? What the hang are we going to do?
Change the culture.
How? Almost a contradiction. Can I give you this axiom? It's a bit scary. There can be no... How can I put it this way? An institution, by definition, is resistant to change. Refounding is impossible for any organization if that organization wishes to remain as is. And at the subconscious level, it does wish to remain as is. Therefore, we have to invoke a new pastoral axiom. And it's an axiom that Jesus, in fact, spoke about at least three times. And what is the axiom? Yes. Ah, this is it. Yes. New wine in new wineskins. What's the other expression? You don't put an old patch, a new patch on an old garment. What's the next? What else did he say? Yes, yes, yes. It's not quite it, but that's broadly. No, let the dead bury the dead. In other words, do not seek to do that which is impossible.
go around it. Run after life, not death. Now, I'll come back to explain this. Now, another, there are at least four times he spoke about this. What's the other one? When he's, yes.
Brush the dust off the sandals.
Absolutely it, yes. If they do not receive you, take your sandals off and buzz off to where there is life. To where there is life. Do not seek to evangelize that which is dead. Let the dead bury the dead. Now this, the implications of this are very, very widespread, very, very deep and very complex. I summarize the words of Jesus in this sense. The new belongs elsewhere. The new belongs elsewhere. Can I just, I'll explain it, but I'll just go back a bit further. In my work with religious congregations, I'm becoming more and more aware that many are incapable of refounding. You can talk to your blue in the face and nothing will happen. And nothing can happen apart from some miraculous intervention of God. So deep is the resistance of the culture to radicality of change. So great is the resistance to confronting chaos. It's frightening experiences, you know. Let's go back again, therefore, to the new belongs elsewhere. What do we mean by this? In the secular world, it's become an axiom. Japanese business people entering into the United States initially would buy up existing auto plants, existing factories. Then they discovered it would not work because they were buying into existing cultures with all the resistance that cultures have. So what do they do? Build anew entirely. Another example. Ford. Henry Ford initiated the motor car as we have it. He was a founding person par excellence. But he lived too long, and by the time of his death, the Ford company was in danger of bankruptcy. Why?
He couldn't adjust.
He produced the Model A. Do you remember the Model A?
No.
Well, I do. Yeah, congratulations. Well, there's honesty somewhere. He produced the Model A and the Model T. Black color, remember? Always black. And he kept producing them. They were tremendously popular. But he forgot that people's tastes were changing. They no longer wanted just black cars. No longer did they want seats that were totally uncomfortable. So his company began to move towards bankruptcy, but he couldn't see it. Henry Ford II came along and refounded the company. How did he refound the company? Not by using the existing plants that produced the Model T and the Model A, but by building, every time he built a new auto, he would establish a new plant. Never use the previous plant. Build from scratch the new culture. Go around the culture. Has anybody had a heart operation bypass here? Two of us. And I think that both of us have had this experience in order to share with them what the new belongs elsewhere really means. You see, the night, the day I had, I was told by the surgeon I had to have an operation, I said, that's fine, that's good. That night I had a dream. And the dream was this. That the big toe called the meeting of the right foot, big toe on the right foot, called the meeting of the whole body. Because the big toe had heard that the three dying arteries were complaining. Why should we be bypassed and allowed to die? We have a right to die, a right to live. Remember that? A right to live. So the big toe articulated the complaints and said to the rest of the body, what do you think? And the little toe on the left foot said, after contemplative reflection, I think we have to ask the question, what do the arteries exist for? What's the primary purpose of the arteries? And the three dying arteries belonging to a noble body had a conversion. They said, we exist for the whole body, not for ourselves. Ah, said the big toe on the right foot. Now you realize that you have to be bypassed for the sake of the life of the whole body. That the surgeon can't push the ice cream and the cakes of decades away through the arteries. Therefore, the two legs said, we offer our veins to become turned upside down and become new arteries. And the three dying arteries said, thank you. And the body said, thank you. So, the new belongs elsewhere. The analogy of the body. Makes sense? Did you have a dream like that? You had dreams.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in the same fashion. I always had this dream of a rear end collision. And I would wake up in the night and that would be frightening. The week before I went away to join the congregation, I joined the others, I almost had a rear end accident. And for some reason, I guess that stuck with me. I was, working like around the clock. I've been doing this for several years. And this dream kept reoccurring more often. That something, this terrible thing was going to happen. Well, it did come about, something did happen. I finished my breakfast one morning, and the school where I was teaching, we had a faculty council joining it. And I went up to my room to brush my teeth and get ready to go to school. So as I was about to do that, I had this tremendous pain shot up and down like in both arms and across my shook. So I sat down for a minute and got myself together again and finally brushed my teeth and went over to the school and went on as usual. But at lunchtime, I came over for lunch and I could just about walk up the steps because I was getting a tight feeling and pain around the wrist. So I called a doctor and he was out of town, so I talked to the other doctor in the office. And he told me, he said, what you need is a catheterization and so on and so forth. So about 3 or 4 weeks later, I got catheterization and eventually I had a bypass done. Since that time, I have not
dreamed. Fascinating. The bypass, in fact, therefore, has led to the fullness of life. So you see the analogy of nature. What cannot be changed must be bypassed. Now, that pastorally, of course, is a very difficult thing to face. To have to discern that this organization or this group is unable to be moved forward. The only way through this is to recognize that the mission has the rights ultimately. The life has the rights. Not subject, the organization must always be in light of the mission. Now, can you think of pastoral examples in your ministry of how this axiom applies? Or how would you apply it in what you are already doing? You see the question? Yes.
Would it be possible to say you have a somewhat lifeless parish, and
yes,
you came in and you sort of established a small faith sharing group or something like this, a sub-community,
yes,
which sort of it was alive and brought new life to the parish such that maybe even it could attract members of the parish at large to this smaller subgroup and therefore kind of reinvigorate the parish
from below. Yes, I fully agree, and I've seen it happen. Yes, I've seen it happen. Have others seen this happening? In other words, what develops is a new grouping in light of the mission. There's no past history, there's no past baggage. And individuals seeing it can be moved to do either to join or to do something like it. Okay? Any other examples? It's a perfect example. So in other words, there are a lot of structures in parish life that simply have had it, have just finished, have no possibility of revitalization, not just renewal, but I mean of real revitalization.
I think you have to let those die.
Precisely.
You know, those arteries had to
die. The three arteries had to die.
And as you just said, build a new.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Through new processes. Yes, yes.
You know, I'm thinking it's a tradition in Australian parishes to have a Legion of Mary. And most of them now are very elderly ladies who can't do any of the visitation and things they used to do. So now they tend to meet regularly every week and pray the rosary and their special prayers, but they don't do any of the evangelization that they were founded for originally. They're too old, they can't do that. And that's happened in a number of parishes. One I'm in now. They're very faithful to meeting, but they just can't
do
the visitation and
yes.
the good charity works that they used to do.
Yes.
Well, they came to me and said, can we get some new members? And I said, sure, you ask for new members. And so we did a little splurge through the parish newsletter, and a couple of them spoke at the end of Mass, and they picked up one lady who was 76. So I said, well, that's wonderful. You've got an extra person. But they're just going to die out.
Yes.
Physically, they're going to die.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we have to let that happen.
Yeah.
This
before I do you see why now, even more deeply?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are okay. Evident. We could say the same with Holy Name Societies in the United States.
Yes.
Same setup. I heard of a more radical one, which I'm not sure is correct, but this was a pastor who was running religious instruction for children in a traditional way, sort of an academic setting. They would come to class an hour a week and the whole structure of academia. And he became convinced that that was leading nowhere. There were all sorts of problems with it. So he said he would never do that again. He went to a new parish, and he only runs religious instruction through the family, that the whole family has to gather. And he refuses to have any religious instruction for a child whose family won't come. And he says, you're not going to win the other way. And that's a possibility.
It's certainly a possibility, yeah. Anybody else?
Just returning to that, that's a very common experience, especially in all the urban parishes. But it requires great pastoral flexibility.
Yes.
When we were younger at Vatican Council, I saw myself at that threshold.
Yes.
And I was a midwife birthing the new church.
Yes.
And I was pushing the church to the other side of the threshold. I get older, and I realize my funeral director, on the backside
yes.
as well
yes.
of
yes.
the yeah. threshold. And I have to do both.
Yes.
And that's very important.
Absolutely.
You have the ability
yes.
to
yes.
birth
yes.
and to rest.
Yeah. I like that distinction between the birthing and the funeral director. You're not leaving them totally to themselves. You're making a decision that this is not where the life is going to come for. This group here is, but you can't just leave them alone. But your approach, pastoral approach, is different. Anybody else?
When I was small, and probably most of us were, we lived in parishes where the parish was the center of all our life, our social life and everything else.
Yes.
And in many ways, that's been the model for most of us. You try to go into a place where it still is the center of everything, and many parishes are, but the place that I walk into, there's nothing going. What I had to do, I think, was just scrap the model.
That's
start
it.
With the idea of small communities, like you were saying.
Yes.
Now, see any group. Now, the basic one that I had was CCD parents, religious instruction, then go into bereavement, parenting, and respect life, anything you can get people to come out for. And scrap the model of you're going to get huge groups of people to come out for anything.
Yes.
They're going to be part of the parish to worship together, but their connection with the parish will be mainly through the small groups. And the other thing is prayer groups.
It's brilliant. Do you hear this? The model perfectly fits, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's the only way. I have a parish where they're just moved up from the city. They really don't have any connections, and they don't want to be too connected except
yes.
just to come to Mass. It's the only way I possibly can figure you can work with them.
Yes. Yes.
So those who want it and those who just want to zip in and zip out supermarket church.
Yes. 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 Yes.
especially the last marriage.
Yes. Well,
I'm finding exactly the same problem in Catholic hospitals. I visited, I think, a Catholic hospital, I may have mentioned it earlier, I'm not sure if I mentioned it here, somewhere here in the United States, to do a sort of a consultancy job on it. And after a few days, I came to the conclusion the only thing Catholic was the name. Exactly the same situation. The assumption, they're not meeting the need, and the assumption is that if you got to school, it was as it was before. So there's constant need for every pastoral program to be assessed according to the mission. Now, here is an example that I've been involved in just from the outside. Two men of my congregation in New Zealand, two very, I don't know, late 30s, early 40s, were very dissatisfied with precisely the same problem you were speaking about. And also that the parishes in a certain area were not touching the marginal migrant peoples. So they came up with a plan, and they took it to the bishop and to their major superior. And the plan was this. They said, look, existing parochial structures do not touch migrant peoples, especially depressed groups. They will not come to the rectory. They described to me what it was like, what people said to them about the rectory, this big building, and this migrant person whose self-esteem had disintegrated. She described how she would go try to get up to the rectory, and she'd get a little way along the drive and then look up at this huge building. And she said, I can't. I'm not worthy to knock on the door. She would turn away and go away. And one woman said to me, what was like going into the Catholic Church where all these white people are? She said, Father said to me, you've got to go to church, Mary. Well, I said, well, Father, yes. Well, yeah. One day I decided to go on a Sunday. She said, it was like this. I enter the church, and I don't know where to sit or to stand. I feel they're looking at me, my petticoat hanging down, hat on right. So I get into the back seat and sit down. And they're all so quiet, no singing. Dull sermon and no singing, nothing going on. Then Father says, let's give the sign of peace to each other. I thought to myself, now they must come alive. And a fish came out. You know? I mean, this is very great, you know, it's very graphic wording. Fish came out. Well, there's no life there. And then Father said, at the end of Mass, go now and live the Mass! Well, she said, perhaps something happens now. I'll go out and see. They may come out and shake my hand and be very happy with me. But I came out, I was almost pushed over, because there must have been a fire somewhere. They rushed out, got into the cars, zoomed! And I was left all by myself. Now, that's the background, which is not uncommon, is it? Not uncommon. No, this one. And so what these two then did was to recommend to the bishop that three parishes cease to exist as traditional parishes, and that they be given the charge of a pastoral region where the focus would not be on existing parochial structures but on the equivalent of basic Christian communities. Now, the bishop said yes. Now, the two of them said, Bishop, all we're asking of you is to police the boundaries, keep the priests out from interfering, keep people from away from us. You publish what we're going to do. You become the St. Sebastian. You receive the arrows while we get on with the job. And the bishop said yes.
And the major superior said, we will give you continuity for at least 5 years. Well, it's gone beyond 5 years now, but go on and on. And it's working. It's working. But it could not work without the legitimization of the bishop policing the boundaries. Now, when we come to look at gossip and scapegoating, these two men became the objects of witch hunting by the priests in the parishes surrounding, who felt this is breaking all the rules of the church, etc., 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 poaching our people and so on and so on, and the money. See? So it required the right structures in order that the life could develop. Well, yes.
We are now going back to the center of
the triangle. Yes. It, and it's, yes, you're right, and there's a whole problem, again, of we priests struggling with who are we? What's our primary purpose? Personally, I do not see there's any way through, ultimately, the change process, except through small groupings. Here's another example, before we move on to the witches. I was asked by the Jesuits to establish a research unit, pastoral research unit, in Manila. And shrewd. They were very shrewd. And they said to me, we want you to establish it, and we do not want you to be involved in anything else but that. We want all your energies for that. Fine, oh, this is fantastic. Now, the directors then called the staff and said, Jerry is here to establish a research unit. He's not to lecture. He's not to be invited into any committees. This is his full-time job. I said, oh, that's great. That's great, Tom. That's very good, Tom. That's brilliant, Tom. I started to work. Within the first week, knock, knock. Hey, Jerry, a lecturer hasn't turned up. Can you just slip in for an hour? Oh, I don't think. You better go and see Tom. Tom said, no. Month later, what about joining the committee on academic assessments? Go and see Tom. No. Eventually the message got across that my boundaries were protected in light of the task and the energy that could be directed to that and not absorbed into other areas, important but not related to the primary task. But it could not have been done if the director hadn't policed the boundaries. So it again is critical with bishops, with the legitimate authorities, to, if they're not on board, it's pretty impossible. Well, if the priest is not on board and others want to get on with the job, it's not possible. I'd like to look now at witches. Witches. Witches and envy. And it comes under the question of barriers. Witches and envy. Gossip and scapegoating are the themes here. Remember, in the symptoms of the chaos, you will find listed there gossip and scapegoating and envy. These are realities that are always with us, but in times of chaos, they receive an injection of incredible life. They flourish. Now let's have a look at the word gossip. Gossip is prejudicial communication about a person or group not present with a third party. Prejudicial information with a third person about an organization or person not present. Now, what is the function of gossip on the part of the person who gossips? At the heart of the gossip is the desire for security, power, and aggressive action over other people. In the chaos, you lose a sense of identity. You lose a sense of power. But if I gossip to John here, about John, what do you feel? Do you feel flattered that I've asked you, of all the group, to be the receiver of the... So, for that moment, the receiver of the gossip feels, by Jove, Jerry has chosen me as the confidant of the gossip. And in that moment, there's a fragility, there's a fragile sense of bonding. But it's very fragile. Why is it fragile? Because you go away and I say to myself, oh my God, John may gossip about me. So the real depth of bonding is very, very weak. Now the other element of gossip is, if I gossip about John to you, both of us experience power over him. We put him down. And it gives us a sense of passing self-esteem. Now remember, gossip and gossiping intensify in the chaos. But what's the result of gossiping? What's the consequence of gossiping? A further development of mistrust, further evasiveness, divisiveness, further de-energization of the group away from the mission, and more isolation of people who want to get on with the job. Okay, now that's gossip. Now you see it running through, right through both testaments. Can you think of examples? Beginning with the book of Genesis. The devil, the serpent, gossiping with Adam and Eve about God. He's not what you think he is. That's gossip. And the aim is to depower God in the presence of Adam and Eve. And they feel very flat. We can become as gods. Another example. Cain and Abel. Another example. Joseph and his multicolored cloak. The brothers of Joseph. Another example in the New Testament. You get many, of course. Remember when Jesus spoke and they said, Jesus, we know his father. You know, the put down. All right. Gossip is bad enough, but watch for its public expression. Witch hunting. Can you, Americans amongst us, can you identify a very famous experience of witch hunting? McCarthyism. When did it start? 1950s. What is that significant? What is that? Why is that date significant? Korean War. And what was happening in the Korean War? You certainly weren't winning. No. Now, notice this. A country committed to success by its founding story is finding itself held as hostage by a group of peasant soldiers. The greatest military power on earth is held at ransom by a group of third world peasants. The self-esteem has disintegrated. There is chaos. There is low-level morale. This is the rich seedbed for witch hunting. There must be a simple course. Witch hunting gives us the opportunity to assign the blame to somebody out there or some group identifiable. It moves the responsibility away from me to somebody else. Removes the guilt from me to somebody else. Now, what also, therefore, I will seek out individuals who are assigned, who are assumed to be the causes of the breakdown of morale. McCarthy, West Virginia, Wheeling, West Virginia. Of all, interesting that he chose Virginia, West Virginia too. Where he made his speech, 201 communists in high government positions, or 202. And suddenly, logical people like you and me, rational people like you and me, don't be too humble. Suddenly we said, he's right. All logic and rationality evaporated out of what appeared, what should have been an intelligent group of people. And they said, he's right. And hence they started this incredible and tragic destruction of the reputation of thousands and thousands of innocent people. Nobody ever asked him initially, give us the proof. Those senators who did, there was one senator in particular who did, he lost his seat. Finally, he was brought to task. But after many, many thousands had suffered. So, we've got here what we speak of as witch hunting, which is public gossip. Public gossip. Now, another quality to this. Is this a quality of the contemporary church? Is there a certain degree of witch hunting going on? What was that? Well, the point is, it's highly predictable. We have to expect it. Every time in the church in which there is a radical breakdown of felt order, e-reformation, or a radical development of urbanization, an economic change, at the period, for example, or even of the Inquisition, wasn't just the Reformation, where the church is confronted with chaos within itself, that's when the witch hunting reaches incredible levels of intensity. Now, here's a question to you. As you reflect on what is happening in the church, in witch hunting, can you identify the groups of people who are seen as the witches? And why? Yes. Liturgists? Yes. Anybody else? Yes, they can be. It's true. Yes, yes. But from the point of view of the institutional church, what categories are seen as the witches? We've got a fair number. Who? Feminists, yes. Feminists? Anybody else? Another huge category now. Yes, liberals, that would come under the title of theologians, I suppose. Educators? Yes. The poor. The poor. Remember now, in economic rationalism, under Thatcherism, etc., to be poor, it's basically your own fault. and you've got to do something about it. But you see, when it, like liberation theologians, it's the attack upon them is also an attack upon the poor. Now, what characterizes all these people who are seen as witches? What's the common denominator? Yes, by their very liminal position, yes. But they are powerless people. They cannot defend themselves. You see, the witch hunter looks for the powerless people. The bullies. Witch hunting is bullying. Witch hunting is ritual public bullying. And they cannot answer. They haven't got the political strength to respond back. They become marginalized, the powerless people. You see, at the time of the Middle Age Inquisition period, it seems that the following categories of people were most considered to be witches and therefore subjected to death. Women and the poor. And the Jews. Women, poor, and Jews. They were, now notice this, they were already marginal peoples. Women had no power politically in medieval times. No power, second-class citizens. Therefore, if, for example, I go into church, I'm a rich man, I'm a duke, I go into church, and there's a poor woman begging. And I give her some money. And I go and I think myself very kind, very good. I come out and she wants more. I go home and the following day, my son dies. Who done it? The witch. The only access to justice is through supernatural manipulation. They have no political access to power. So also, theologians have no access to power in institutional world. Women have no access to power. Therefore, they are assumed to be manipulating behind the scenes to destroy the institutional church. Make sense? Do you see the dynamic? Now, we must end. The question is this. What do we do about this? How do you confront it? How do you confront it? Go back to one of the first axioms. What is culture? And what is chaos? Can you confront this with rational argument alone? It's going to the source. In other words, for example, in the case of women, unless women have access to normal structures whereby their voice can be heard within structures accepted, then they will continue to be the objects of witch hunting. Similarly with the poor, the marginalized. If they have not got access by right into structures, they have no way of being heard or of being avoided as the objects of witch hunting. One final comment. We're going to look at envy, but we may look at that tomorrow. And that's another critical dynamic. Andrew Greeley spoke way back in the 60s. He said, the clerical sin is envy. Adrian Van Kaam said the same. The clerical sin is envy. Perhaps we'll have a chance to look at that a little later. Is this helpful? Okay. When do we meet? Oh, 10, that's right. Yes, 10 o'clock. Yes. Well, I thought it was later. Yes, it was Friday. Right. Yes.